In January 2025, Eskom, South Africa's electricity monopoly, announced its first round of load shedding in over 10 months. Load shedding basically meaning rolling blackouts to prevent the grid from collapsing. 2024 had been a good year, relatively. Just 83 days of load shedding, not too bad after 332 days in 2023 and over 200 days of power cuts in 2022. Eskom is one of South Africa's biggest companies. It is also arguably its most important. And it is in shambles. In this video, the story of a state-owned electricity monopoly that triggered an energy crisis. We have a lot of ground to cover in this video, so forgive me for skipping a few things. The first electric lights came to South Africa's town of Kimberley in 1882, just 2 years after the invention of the incandescent lamp. Arc lamps installed on the Table Bay docks extended the day's working hours. It was claimed that the lamps helped recruit African natives because they flocked to see the lights switch on all at once, without anyone to light them. After this, South Africa's various cities began installing their own street lights and electricity systems. These were set up and operated by small municipal utilities. After a slow start, the industry grew rapidly thanks to the miners, namely the miners of the Witwatersrand gold fields, the world's largest known gold reserves. In the 6,000 years leading up to the 21st century, mankind is known to have mined about 82,000 tons of gold. 34,000 tons of that gold came from South Africa's Transvaal province and Orange Free State, where the Witwatersrand gold fields are. At first, human laborers did the hard work, but the gold fields, though wide and consistent, dipped sharply into the earth at an angle of 60 degrees. This forced the miners to dig ever so deeper. In 1899, the deepest shaft went down 1,100 meters. By 1910, that was 1,850 meters. Moreover, gold as a product is special. Countries at the time tied their currencies to gold, making its international quote-unquote price fixed. So unlike with other mined goods, the gold miners cannot raise their gold prices to compensate for inflating costs like materials or labor. Rising costs and fixed revenues. This forced the gold miners to automate, adopting drills and transport powered by electricity or compressed air. Ventilation fans were installed to cool the miners so they can keep on working. These practices spread to South Africa's rich diamond and coal mines too. Machines were used to mechanically turn over diamond-bearing ores and cut coal. But the gold fields and the powerful gold miners led the way. One private company monopolized the lucrative job of providing the gold miners with their electricity. The Victoria Falls Power Company, a British venture funded with some German money. It started with hydroelectric, but hit its stride in mining and burning coal. As it grew, its size and dominance unnerved many. World War I massively industrialized the Dominion. The need for soldiers created labor shortages. The state coordinated and directed resources into industry and planned production. Disruptions in shipping forced industry to make more things at home. Such trends depend on electricity and capacity grew. The war's end, however, left things in a bit of a slump. So in steps the South African Railways Company. They saw a chance to electrify their trains to save labor and take advantage of cheap power trends in the post-war slump environment. However, they did not want to buy their electricity from the municipal or private providers, the latter especially, considering the then already powerful status of the Victoria Falls Power Company. Instead, they wanted a centralized electricity provider run by the state. The state saw other reasons to build such a provider. There was the desire to realize economies of scale in supplying electricity to the cities, industry, and the train networks at cost. There was concern about South Africa's near total economic reliance on its gold miners, an industry that nobody would ever refer to as being very stable, as well as concern stemming from a string of labor strikes at the city power stations by laborers radicalized by communism and the founding of the Soviet Union during the war. Such things plunge the cities into chaos. The government of Prime Minister Jan Smuts, including the advisor and industrialist Hendrik van der Bijl, realized that South Africa had to control its own power supply to help diversify its economy, and that power supply cannot be beholden to a few striking employees or monopolistic private companies. Thus, South Africa passed the Electricity Act of 1922, creating the Electricity Supply Commission, or ESCOM, and its overseeing regulatory body, the Electricity Control Board. ESCOM is a state-owned company tasked with a mandate. That mandate was to supply electricity to the railways, government, and industry at the lowest possible cost. They cannot make a profit or loss, were exempt from income tax, and raised capital through bonds. The government owned the company, and their commissioners were appointed by the state, but ESCOM received a light political touch. The South African government created ESCOM to support their vision of state capitalism. After World War I, Jan Smuts and his ministers wanted to diversify their economy away from mining. ESCOM and the railways would support that goal with cheap, reliable power and transportation. And to provide another critical input, the government founded the South African Iron and Steel Industrial Corporation, ISCOR, in 1928. In 1932, South Africa went off the gold standard, devaluing its currency. This caused gold prices and gold miner profits to soar. Between 1933 and 1948, electricity consumption grew five times over, thanks to the gold mining industry's prosperity, the rising use of electric machines, urbanization, and a big industrialization push leading up to and during World War II. In 1948, ESCOM purchased the Victoria Falls Power Company, South Africa's last large privately owned utility. This consolidated the Dominion's power industry from the power stations to the transmission lines in a single company. In line with Smuts' philosophy of state capitalism, his administration founded other state-owned enterprises to encourage industrial development. Notably, the Industrial Development Corporation helped fund private industrialists, and of course, the energy company Sasol, which produced oil from cheap coal using industrial processes. Today, Sasol is one of South Africa's most well-known companies. Smuts' administration conceived Sasol, but the company actually began in 1950. By then, a far different administration had taken power. In 1948, Smuts' United Party lost a critical election to the Reunited National Party, led by Afrikaner nationalists. I need to compress some 250 years of history into a few minutes. The Afrikaners are descendants of Dutch, German, and French settlers who settled in the 17th and 18th century. Over time, they developed a fiercely independent national identity. In 1806, the British occupied and took over the colony. This created deep conflicts with the Afrikaners, who did not appreciate perceived British efforts to eliminate their identity. Such conflicts led to two devastating wars, the second of which was especially brutal. Jan Smuts had been a moderate Afrikaner who aligned South Africa with Britain during the two world wars. Internationally, he was much admired, and at home, his policies delivered many economic successes, but at a serious social cost. Life for black South Africans certainly was not great, but it had improved, notably with their increasing employment in semi-skilled jobs. By 1948, two-thirds of such workers were black, threatening the livelihood of less educated white workers. In 1948, the Afrikaners tapped latent white fears of black economic and political aspirations by proposing a system of separation along racial lines. It would limit black migration and protect jobs for poorer whites. The election system then favored whites, rural ones in particular. The Reunited National Party, later the National Party after merging with another party, united Afrikaners across all class lines and won a mandate for what we now call apartheid. The National Party ran South Africa for almost the next 50 years. Economy-wise, it was a tale of two halves. In the first half, the country's standards of living, for whites anyway, greatly improved. The economy grew, by some accounts phenomenally well, but by other accounts just fairly well, but it grew. Abroad, the Bretton Woods Agreement pegged world currencies to the US dollar and the dollar to gold. This system guaranteed stable gold prices and earned South Africa regular amounts of foreign exchange. At the same time, labor wages were low, thanks to apartheid policies that excluded blacks from certain jobs and tied them to specific areas. This allowed the gold miners to reap substantial profits, raising money from abroad to fund new mines. Exports of other South African items, diamonds, copper, uranium, grew too. At home, South Africa implemented import substitution. High tariffs incentivized companies to build factories in South Africa. In 1933, 0% of the content in a boiler and steam plant was made at home. By 1950, that was 50%, 1968, 85%. All those new factories needed power. In the early years after the National Party takeover, Eskom struggled to meet all this new demand. Eskom did not have enough power plants and could not source enough coal due to political disputes with coal mine owners. Having equipment at the gold mines suddenly shut off due to high loads would not only be financially devastating, but also probably leave a few people dead. So Eskom had to do what was called load shedding, deliberate outages to prevent a total grid collapse. This went on from 1949 to 1951, with 1951 the worst. Spreading the load helped the gold mines cope. They often shut down non-essential equipment, but Eskom still direly needed new power stations. To get the money for it, they turned to the United States and the United Kingdom, which needed South Africa's uranium. Starting in 1951 and continuing over the next few years, the U.S. Export-Import Bank and the predecessor to the World Bank lent tens of millions of dollars to Eskom to meet its capacity needs. The money funded several new power stations located near high-quality coal fields. The coal here was easy to get, thick and shallow. Combined again with cheap and exploited black labor, Eskom ended its power crisis by 1960 to provide some of the world's cheapest power. So that was the first half of National Party rule. The second half did not go so well, sending the country into economic stagnation. For Eskom, things started off hot. In 1971, U.S. President Richard Nixon ended Bretton Woods, freeing global gold prices. By 1974, gold surged to five times its 1968 prices. The gold miners boomed. Soon after that, the oil crises of the 1970s sent oil prices sky high, so South Africans adopted electricity. Peak power loads grew between 6 to 16% each year from 1972 to 1982. Eskom's reserve margin, the amount of available capacity above peak demand, fell to just 11% in 1975. Meanwhile, political tensions between white and black South Africans were bubbling to the surface. Protests by black schoolchildren against the teaching of the Afrikaans language in 1974 led to the Soweto uprising in 1976. The South African government responded with brutality, leaving dozens dead. South Africa's political isolation only worsened with its increasingly aggressive military incursions into neighboring Angola. Facing embargoes, the government responded with an industrial push towards self-sufficiency. So, Eskom managers, forecasting 7 to 8% annual demand growth and responding to a call to achieve energy independence to counteract this growing political isolation, embarked on a massive coal power plant building spree. Coal plants popped up across the Mpumalanga Highveld region, taking advantage of the area's rich coal fields. By 1983, Eskom had 11 gigawatts of generating capacity and another 22 gigawatts on order. Unfortunately, Eskom fumbled the expansion. First, their coal plants were getting increasingly larger. Average power plant capacity in the 1950s was 440 megawatts. By the 1980s, 3,600 megawatts. This was done in pursuit of economies of scale, but at the cost of high interest expenses, long lead times, and engineering inflexibility. South Africa's only nuclear power plant, Coburg, was commissioned during this time too, 1976. This was a Framatome design imported from France. I mentioned this sale in a previous video about the French nuclear build-out. As typical of these things, Coburg II suffered delays and cost overruns, costing Eskom half a billion South African rand. Eskom's expectations of economic growth had also been too rosy. In the early 1980s, the gold boom ended. Gold prices reached a peak of $850 per ounce in January 1980. Prices fell back a bit in March, but then stormed back to $680 by September 1980. From there, gold prices collapsed to just $304 per ounce by mid-1982. This drop in gold prices ended South Africa's key source of foreign exchange. To add, political pressure cuts off the South African government from IMF loans, forcing the National Party to make moves to avoid the balance of payments crisis it knew its economy was always vulnerable to. This adds up to Eskom messing up bad. The company was incurring debt building these big, inflexible power plants that were not being fully utilized and passing the costs on to consumers in the form of higher rates. Rates rose 20% alone between 1976 and 1977. These rate increases came at a time of economic difficulty and high inflation for South Africans, and the resulting consumer anger led to the government to form the De Villiers Commission in 1983. The commission found issue with Eskom's governance and investment decisions, resulting in several governance changes, as well as a renaming to Eskom with a K. For decades, Eskom operated with little oversight. This largely ended with these new reforms. In the late 1980s, South Africa's economy was sputtering due to sanctions and heavy debt. In 1989, F.W. de Klerk took power, promoting deregulation and privatization as ways out of the economic crisis. State-owned companies like Iscor, South African Railways, and Sasol were restructured with the intention of being sold off, though only Iscor was. The changes applied to Eskom as well, changing it from a public service providing electricity at cost to something more of a private company, beholden to the market. Responding to what was perceived as a massive overbuild, Eskom in 1985 delays or cancels ongoing power station projects. They dialed down their 7% forecasts. Even so, in 1992, Eskom's reserve margin was as high as 40%. Its electricity generation costs were some of the lowest in the world, thanks to super cheap, high quality coal sourced on long-term supply contracts. So, Eskom strikes multi-year energy deals, sometimes long as 25 years, with the mining companies, heavy energy users like aluminium smelters. These turned out to be very poor deals. I know that they thought they had the capacity at the time, but that situation was about to change. Going into the 1990s, domestic unrest in South Africa remained rampant, with some areas ungovernable. The National Party realized that apartheid could no longer be sustained, the black majority can no longer be denied. So in 1990, several black-led political parties were unbanned, and talks began. The negotiations lead to open elections in 1994. Nelson Mandela leads the African National Congress, or ANC, party to victory. They've been running the country ever since and remain in power. The ANC inherited an Eskom that provided power mostly to mining, heavy industry, and white homes/businesses. Black homes were unconnected. 62% of homes, and 86% of schools. So it should be, then, that one of Eskom's mandates in the ANC era is to connect those black communities. It did this quite well, though it did cost an immense amount of money to build these transmission networks. From 1994 to 2004, Eskom added 2.4 million households to the grid. Black South Africans who never had electricity before can now ditch the candles, buy a hot plate, and maybe even a TV. At the same time, the end of apartheid brings foreign capital back to South Africa. The economy starts growing again. Thanks to these two trends, as early as 1996, Eskom eats up all of its prior spare capacity. The utility soon realizes that it needs to build new power plants. Strangely, the ANC did not allow it to build those new plants. The party, despite its Marxist-Leninist origins, took the line that the electricity market should have more private participation. A 1998 paper envisioned 30% of the country's power coming from the private sector by 2004. In this plan, Eskom would be fully corporatized and then unbundled, with each of its segments facing private sector competitors. its distribution functions be given to 6 regional electricity distributors. For this reason, ESCOM was prevented in 1998 from building new power plants. The government thought that that work should be carried out by the forthcoming private sector. But this reform plan was never carried out in full. The corporatization part of it was. ESCOM became ESCOM Holdings, fully owned by the state with a management board and, somewhat importantly, the requirement to pay corporate taxes on its profits. The rest of the plan, however, no. The unions and other political bodies resisted privatization, seeing ESCOM as a tool to meet development goals, and the municipal bodies made money from reselling ESCOM's electricity. They objected to losing that revenue stream. This policy uncertainty went on until 2004 when the ANC finally said that ESCOM would remain a vertically integrated monopoly. That year, the government finally gave ESCOM permission to build once more. ESCOM started planning to build 2 new large coal power plants. You'll hear about those in a little bit. In the meanwhile, several older plants would be upgraded as a bridge, but it was too late. Demand grew 30% faster than supply between 1997 and 2005, causing ESCOM's reserve margin to fall to about 8%, less than half the international standard. Then, in January 2008, heavy rains plunged the country into blackouts. ESCOM had earlier switched away from its established coal suppliers in favor of lesser-known mines, mostly black-owned. Stocks had been kept low, presumably to save on storage costs. So when the rains came, the coal turned into sludge, clogging up the chutes and shutting down the power plants. Blackouts ensued, grinding South Africa's mines and economy as a whole to a halt. The national economy lost 2 billion rand a day, estimated, during a global commodity boom, not to mention all the damage done to smaller businesses and residences hit by the mild inconvenience of not having power. The power plants ESCOM built in the late 1970s and 1980s are old, requiring maintenance and repair. Replacements are needed. But years had passed since ESCOM built a power plant, and amidst all the changes, they had sort of forgotten how to do it. For this reason, amongst others, their first new power plant megaprojects, Medupi and Kusile, turned into boondoggles of near-nuclear magnitude. ESCOM estimated in 2005 that it would cost about 93 billion rand, or about 14.5 billion USD, to build 4 new power plants. Medupi and Kusile were the linchpins of this replacement plan. The 2 plants had about 4.8 gigawatts of capacity each and were scheduled to be operational by 2012 and 2013, respectively. But then came the delays and cost overruns. Why? The usual. Inexperienced project management, technical problems leading to expensive rework and imported replacements, labor unrest and strikes, and of course, rampant corruption via inflated contracts and kickbacks. Medupi's 6 units all finally reached operational status in 2021, 14 years after construction began. Kusile also had 6 units, and it took 11 years for the first to deliver power. 1 unit remains under construction even now. Publicly, ESCOM says that the 2 units together cost about 307 billion rand, or about $21 billion. An independent energy analyst in 2019 notes that this number ignores additional costs like capitalized interest. That adds an extra $4 billion to give you a mind-boggling $25 billion cost. That's a TSMC fab. Mind you, these 2 projects are not nuclear stations. These are coal power plants, yet they basically bankrupted the company while not delivering power for over a decade. I need to mention the poisoning. Corruption is endemic within ESCOM. I don't think that surprises anyone. I mentioned earlier the use of inflated contracts at the Medupi and Kusile projects to siphon off money from the company. In 2019, ESCOM appointed André de Ruyter, CEO of the firm Nampak, as chief executive of ESCOM. He ran the company for 3 years, constantly staggered by the company's problems and constantly getting pummeled politically for trying to deal with them. He later wrote a book about it. In it, he notes ESCOM's issues. It was 80% or so reliant on dirty, carbon-heavy coal. Moreover, those coal plants were old and often broke down due to a lack of scheduled maintenance, no money for repairs, and crappy coal input. Yet Eskom did not have the revenue to fix these issues. The reason was more structural. Municipal distributors resold Eskom's power with high markups, restricting the latter's ability to raise rates. Eskom also had trouble collecting back payments from those distributors. All this meant more money had to be borrowed just to pay the interest on all the crippling debt it already carried, creating a debt spiral that Eskom cannot easily escape. One of De Ruyter's defining battles within the company was trying to get them to move away from coal to adopt renewables like solar and wind, not just because they are quote-unquote green, but because he generally believed it would be cheaper than building another big coal plant. It would attract foreign investment and lead to a more resilient grid. But South Africa's existing energy infrastructure has been heavily dependent on coal for over a century now, and pushing against that angered a lot of entrenched interests, some political slash ideological, some economic, and others criminal. Perhaps most eye-catching of all, De Ruyter claimed that the company had been infiltrated by multiple criminal syndicates, as many as four. Working in hand with employees, they thieve coal, copper, and other materials at will, looting as much as R1 billion, or $55 million, a month. The coal value chain is a particular target, its centralization offering huge opportunities for grift. This culminated in De Ruyter's poisoning. After resigning in December 2022 due to disillusionment with the work, he drank his morning coffee and realized he had been poisoned with cyanide. Soon after that, he gave an explosive public interview talking about the criminal rings and even accusing some high-level ANC politicians of being involved. It got him immediately fired. As I mentioned, South Africa endured a record-breaking 330-plus days of load shedding in 2023. That year had been a hot one. Such high temperatures hit Eskom from two sides. More South Africans turn on air conditioning, hitting demand, and Eskom's sputtering coal plants don't do so well in high temperatures, hitting supply. Load shedding hit stage 6 levels, meaning 6,000 megawatts of power being cut, resulting to 8 to 10-hour-long blackouts almost daily. In 2023, the South African government declared a state of emergency and took on $14 billion of Eskom's debt. Recognizing that their electoral lives were on the line, the ANC would lose an absolute majority in the 2024 election for the first time ever, they set down a plan to build more capacity and bend the demand curve. The plan involved finishing the final units at the Medupi and Kusile power plants, adding cheap renewables capacity, and incentivizing consumers to invest in private power generation like rooftop solar. A departure from the ANC party's traditional resistance to renewables. De Ruyter recalls one ANC official calling it a Western conspiracy to keep African nations from exploiting their natural resources. And that is not a unique view. Stability returned to the grid. 2024 saw 10 months without load shedding, though the company still reported a 25 billion rand loss, or 1.36 billion USD, in 2024. South Africa remains utterly reliant on Eskom, and that is the problem. The government keeps bailing out the company, allowing it to issue new debt in its name. As of 2024, the company has over 400 billion rand, or $25 billion of debt on its books. For decades, cheap coal helped make Eskom's power some of the cheapest in the world, and that drove the country's industrialization and economic development. But now coal isn't so cheap anymore, at least compared to solar and wind energy sources, yet the government is hesitant to recognize this and make the switch, aware of the ideological resistance and pain that a transition will cause to long-standing vested interests. Right now, the government foresees a titanic power shortfall in the next 25 years thanks to rising new demand and retiring coal-fired plants. They cannot afford another Medupi and Kusile-type debacle. The path forward seems clear. Alright everyone, that's it for tonight. Thanks for watching. Subscribe to the channel, sign up for the Patreon, and I'll see you guys next time.